We've had a break in the weather. Today is a sleepy, warm spring day, the first we've seen in several weeks. And weather to the men who have gone through a cold winter and a cold, rainy spring is the biggest boon to their personal lives. Today is a day of relaxation. Besides that, this all comes as some kind of an anticlimax. The news of the big surrender started leaking out, being whispered around early yesterday. Then the radio news programs brought a certain amount of confirmation. So VE Day has come to this headquarters in easy stages. General Bradley was awakened in the early dawn of yesterday by a telephone call from his chief, General Eisenhower.
Brad, the chief asked.
Yes,
Bradley answered.
Well, I've put it over, Ike went on. The surrender will be effective 1 minute after midnight on Tuesday night. They talked a few minutes longer, then General Bradley started his calls to his four Army commanders. Because Patton's Third Army was advancing in an attack through Austria and Czechoslovakia, he was the first to be notified. Get word to all your units, he was told, and stop them in place. No sense in taking casualties now that it's over. And so it went on through the early morning. The news spread through this command. It was all over. By the time of our morning briefing, General Bradley was beaming, waiting to tell his correspondents the good news. At first, we understood VE Day would be celebrated tomorrow, Wednesday. The calendar over General Bradley's war maps was marked ahead to that date. It read, today is May 9, D plus 336. That's the way time has been reckoned over here ever since the historic D-Day, June 6, Normandy landing. May 9 carried special significance for General Bradley, for it was on that day, 1943, just 2 years ago, that he accepted his first big wholesale surrender from the Germans. It was in North Africa. The general then commanded the 2nd Corps, consisting of 5 American divisions. The surrender then was from the crack German troops making up the Africa Corps in northern Tunisia. The surrender this time was to his Fuhrer army. Probably the nearest thing to a celebration is the assembly we have here in our press camp. Officers and men representing these four armies. Men who have had some special part in the successful operations of the past. We'll hear from some of them in a later program. But right here with me is Sergeant Joseph A. DeLisio of 1097 Longwood Avenue, Bronx, New York. He's from A Company, 27th Armored Infantry of the 9th Armored Division. One of the first men to seize and cross the Remagen Bridge across the line. Sergeant, we're certainly glad to have you with us here to help celebrate this great day. I suppose you realize you were called in here because you're part in one of the great events that helped hurry up this VE Day. Supposing you tell us about your part in it.
Well, I'm proudest of capturing the German lieutenant who was supposed to blow up the bridge. We had killed 2 of his men when I called for the rest for the surrender. He came out saying, me engineer, bridge, boom. I also think I started that crossing by accident, or luck, or something. When Sergeant Zavik, the first one across, was asking for me,
and I was busy cleaning out 2 machine gunners from the protecting tower, my men said I had gone across. Sergeant Dravick shouted,
if Delicio's over there, he's by himself. Let's go over and help him out. He found himself the first one over, and it turned out then I had to go over and help him out.
Well, Sergeant, that was one of the big stars of the war, as you know.
Now, how do you feel about this VE Day?
Well, I haven't had much time to think about it, but I'm certainly glad it's over. I can hardly believe it. It's like hearing of someone very close to you that has gotten it, has been killed. You can't believe it, and yet you have to realize that it's true. After 7 months of living in foxholes, in rain, mud, snow, and cold, and waiting for someone to come along and tell you we're going to attack again, we're jumping off, and wondering if this is going to be your last time. Well, I just can't explain my feelings.
Well, I can easily believe that, Sergeant DeLisio.
But it is all over, and now I hope you enjoy the rest of your stay here at this headquarters with us. It's VE Day, I'll remind you again.
This is Bill Sedell at General Bradley's headquarters, and now back to CBS in New York.
From General Bradley's headquarters, we switch now to the American 9th Army Front, Bill Slocum, Jr. reporting.
The tired and heroic men of the 9th United States Army put the end of this portion of their war firmly and soberly. Many a quart of cognac and many a gallon of wine when struggling down the throats of the Ninth Army Gulf Road, the brief boys who became men overnight were drinking toast. Toast to the long line of graves that stretched from our rear areas to Brest and the French coast. I had the privilege of telling dozens of soldiers that the war was over. All of them grinned wryly at me and informed me that they'd heard that junk before. When I convinced them, they just laughed, shook hands among themselves, and one of them said to me, "Mister, I wish you'd told us that a year ago." Another outfit heard the news, and one of the boys hit the note that drew immediate agreement from all the rest. He said, "Gee, that's great. The folks back home will be pleased." Last night, they sat around their tents and barracks and talked it over. They talked of many things, of you at home, of those days around Bastogne. And every so often, somebody says, flatly and without much emotion, "Too bad Joe ain't here. He'd have got a big kick out of it." A low chorus of yells would answer, "And then we'll be back in the snow of Bastogne, or with that gal in Brooklyn or Kenosha, or drinking that whole quart of milk they all want so much." I've tried to give you a picture of the American Ninth Army in this moment of triumph. It's not an easy job, because there's an awful lot of Ninth Army. But if it were to be fitting enough squares, it would be something like this. The Ninth helped lift the jury. It did a great job, and it's proud of itself. It hopes the folks back home appreciate the job, and it hopes they're happy today. The Ninth wherever fame and death and lonesomeness has been worthwhile. This is Bill Slocum, Jr. with the Ninth Army in Germany. I return you now to CBS in New York.
That was the Ninth Army. Next to Third Army headquarters, Larry Lesser reporting.
When the ceasefire came, there was little sign of jubilation among the frontline combat troops or officers. Just a general relaxation and a change from the grim tension learned in months of combat to easy American smiles and wisecracks. They really haven't changed very much, these American soldiers. They're proving very adaptable to peace. And besides, they're a lucky one in what they call Frater Slovakia. I have just returned from Czechoslovakia, where the American Army pushed farthest to the east before the ceasefire reached them. The 4th Armored Division plunged into the land Hitler first conquered through the mile-high mountain ring of Bohemia. And the 90th Division Doughboys and the 4th Armored Spearhead yesterday met stubborn resistance from a German officer's training camp fighting in the clouds that draped the Bohemian hills. But we knew when we crossed the German Sudeten land into Bohemia, not from maps, but by the cheers of the Czech people. It was the greatest liberation greeting since we left France. They're not as volatile as the French, these dark, square-chinned Czechs with their wide-set, intelligent eyes. But they are people of great enthusiasm. They greeted us with victory arches constructed of laurel and evergreen, the signs that said, "Victory to the Americans." And the girls in native costume waited for our trunks with large trays of cakes and sandwiches. They didn't ask the Americans for cigarettes or chocolate. These proud and hospitable Czechs gave us gifts. It wasn't much. Just a few of what Germans could not have. But they symbolized an appreciative, generous people. The liberated Czechs were busy wiping out the last traces of German occupation, painting over the German names given to their villages, and they were bringing in prisoners by the score. When the news of the ceasefire came, the Third Army was marching towards the besieged city of Prague. But as I said, all forward movement stopped. Lafarge radio was still imploring the Allies for aid. The Czechs ordered a mass rising of their army, and Czech soldiers took their uniforms out of mothballs and began to march on Prague themselves to relieve their capital from the surrounding SS troops. But at dawn this morning, the movements of the Czech patriots stopped. They learned that the SS troops had ceased fire against Prague, too. And this is Larry Lesser returning you now to New York.
We've heard now from the Third Army, and next we switch to Paris, Charles Collingwood reporting.
Paris victory celebrations are in full swing. They aren't yet, and they may not be very riotous and hysterical, but they're going on. They're not, for instance, as fervent and automatic as the scenes which followed the liberation of Paris, but for the first time since the liberation, there's a real sense of happiness and well-being abroad in the city. The people of Paris are physically too tired and emotionally too exhausted to throw themselves into the wild and uproarious celebration one might have expected. Only the young people right now are really taking advantage of the situation. They're marching up and down the boulevard, singing and dancing and waving flags. They're the only ones, with the soldiers here, the American soldiers, with enough energy left to do justice to the occasion. And they make a fine and happy sight as they parade through the city making their holiday. What it'll be like tonight is hard to say, because Paris is a nighttime town. She gives her best performances by night. And when this evening the city is lit up for the first time in years, Paris may go wild. But today, most people are content just to stroll in the sunshine and feel good. There is nothing glum or unhappy about Paris today. On the contrary, it never looked more beautiful and felt more glamorous. It's just that people are so tired and so glad they want to enjoy their peace in peace. For them, as for us, the war is over. This war in Europe, anyway. And looking back on it, you think of many things. Like the first time you were seized with the awful certainty that you were going to die. And then the way you felt when you discovered that you were not, which is very much like the way one feels now. You think of London under the Blitz, when the sky itself seemed to burn, and the noise of the German bombers, and the sound of people's footsteps running. The day we hit the beaches of Normandy, with the 88s coming in and the pieces of things floating in the water offshore. The way Algiers Harbor looked when we sailed in on the blue water, with the city rising up white on the hills around. You remember, too, the long, cold, muddy days when nothing went right, and men were killed all around and nobody got anywhere. Then there were the days of liberation, with the sun shining and people crying and throwing flowers and reaching out to touch you. And sooner or later, you think of the beginning of the war and the way it was then, September 1939. Or maybe it didn't begin then. Maybe it began in Spain or in China. But for this correspondent, it began in London in September 1939. We didn't know what war was then. You could buy anything you wanted in the stores. Your job wasn't any different than what it was before. Except for those who went into the army, it was just that someone had said there was a war. Everyone thought they could imagine then what it would be like. When the first false air raid sounded in London, everyone crowded into the shelters and had hysterical wardens shouting in their ears to put that cigarette out. You want us all to get killed? And then now, there's that final scene in the map room of the school building Supreme Headquarters in Reims. I stood in the back and watched the German plenipotentiary, Colonel General Jodl, sign the paper that meant it was all over. There they sat around the battered old table that you wouldn't have in your kitchen. And what they were doing was ending it all. In itself, it wasn't a very impressive scene. No fanfares, no production. Everyone did their best to act in a matter-of-fact way. It wasn't the scene itself that made you hold your breath. It was the occasion. It was what it meant. It was the sense that this was the end which sent your mind racing back across all those years that seemed like months and those months that seemed like years. Back to when it began and then through again all the things that had happened. We've come a long way since then. We've learned what war is. We've learned what it takes and how to fight it. We Americans had more to learn and learned it faster than anyone else. When we came to North Africa, our first overseas campaign in the West, we were an army of rank amateurs. We didn't know the first thing about war. It almost seemed as though we didn't want to learn. We learned, though, and in learning, we changed the whole character of modern war. It was a completely different kind of war when it ended than it was when it began. And it was American ideas and techniques as much as anything that changed it. But the war taught us other things as well as the soldiers' trade, things that it would be well to remember. It taught us, first of all, that we couldn't do it alone, that we couldn't separate our effort from the rest. It taught us, too, that an alliance, a partnership of nations, can work. Nations can work together as long as both sides want to enough. And perhaps, most of all, the war taught us, or should have taught us, that you can't buy out of unpleasant things with money or production or inventions or anything. The only response to the basic problems which confront our nation can be faith and sacrifice and cooperation. We have to meet our problems honestly and do what must be done. If the war has taught us that, it has not been in vain. This is Charles Collingwood in Paris, returning you to the Columbia Broadcasting System in New York.
Columbia's correspondents have reported from the 9th and 3rd Armies, from General Bradley's headquarters, and from Paris. Now the Pacific. We switch to CBS Manila, William J. Dunn reporting.
This is Columbia in San Francisco calling Manila. We're sorry, but we seem unable to contact the Philippines this morning. Now back to CBS World News in New York.
Back again in New York. We'll try our correspondents in the Pacific a little later in this program. Perhaps I don't think I've had time yet to tell you that a communique issued by the German High Command this morning and broadcast over that radio station identifying itself as Flensburg announced that henceforth the greeting Heil Hitler will be banned within the German armed forces. Prime Minister Winston Churchill, a few minutes after broadcasting his Victory Day in Europe pronouncement, which we carried over this network, went to a madly cheering House of Commons in London to repeat his epic-making declaration that the arms and might of Germany have bowed to the overpowering strength of the United Nations. He was smiling broadly as he arose to deliver his victory speech. As he appeared from behind the speaker's chair, the whole house rose. Members cheered loudly, and they waved their order papers, while those in the side galleries and the strangers' gallery got to their feet and joined in the thunderous applause. There was another great roar of cheers when the Prime Minister rose and said he thought it might be convenient if he repeated the official statement he had just made on the radio, and then he repeated in full his broadcast announcement. Lord Wilton, the Minister of Reconstruction, read the statement in the House of Lords, which Prime Minister Churchill was making at the same time in the House of Commons, and then the House of Lords adjourned to attend divine service. A deafening cheer greeted the end of Mr. Churchill's message to the nation when he said, in that resounding voice, "Advance, Britannia, long live the cause of freedom, God save the King." And then Mr. Churchill expressed his gratitude to the House, which has proved itself, he said, the strongest foundation for waging war that has ever been seen in the whole of our long history. We have all made our mistakes, but the strength of parliamentary institutions has been shown. And now we are going to try another of our correspondents in the Pacific, so we switch now to Admiral Nimitz's Advanced Fleet Headquarters on Guam, Gene Ryder reporting.
Eisenhower is flown by Fleet Admiral Nimitz, Commander-in-Chief Pacific Fleet and Pacific Ocean Areas. The smashing victory of American and Allied arms over Germany ends a reign of brute force and terror in Europe. Millions of the world's people are beholden to you and the superb forces under your command for the restoration of their right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. The victory confirms the wisdom of our world strategy, which required the use of the bulk of our strength against Germany while holding Japan and driving them back wherever possible. Now the whole overwhelming weight of our force can be turned upon our treacherous enemy in the Pacific. Japan deserves, and from now on will receive, our united and undivided attention. My sincere congratulations to you, your staff, and all the men of your command on the completion of a formidable task supremely well done. That's the way Admiral Nimitz says it, and I'm sure that if all the anonymous men of every rank who faced the Japanese in the Pacific could send a message to the anonymous men of the Allied armies who fought the Germans all over Europe, it would be termed exactly as Admiral Nimitz expressed himself. There's far more reaction here this 1 a.m. than there was last night. The official announcement of victory in Europe had been expected all day, and most everyone has waited up tonight to hear from our world leaders. The armed forces radio stations, usually signed off by 10 p.m., are on the air now, rebroadcasting shortwave programs from stateside, and every radio has a large audience. There aren't any organized celebrations, just little groups of men around radio sets listening to short-waved words coming from half a world away. Speaking from somewhere in the Pacific for the 3rd Marine Division, General Graves B. Erskine, who took his Marines into the center of the Iwo battle to roll back the Japanese, says, "The victory of our mighty forces over Germany was a masterful accomplishment which commands the admiration of every Marine. To the valiant men in Europe, the 3rd Marine Division sends a salute. We've already hit the Japs hard, and we pledge that we will not relax for an instant while the forces in Europe are being moved to the Pacific Theater. But the quicker this is accomplished, the quicker the final knockout blow can be administered." The feelings out here tonight are a mixture of admiration for the job done in Europe and an eagerness to be on the total victory with the full might of America and our allies concentrated on one front. This is Gene Ryder at Guam. I switch you now to Tim LeMert at Okinawa.
This is Tim LeMert off the coast of Okinawa. It has been about 24 hours now since the first word of the German unconditional surrender was received here in Okinawa. Because the initial announcement came in the middle of the night, many of the men inshore and aboard the ship didn't hear of it for several hours. This morning, the news passed over ship public address systems and from command post to command post, from foxhole to muddy foxhole. There were a few shouts, few displays of emotion. To many, it was just another day of fighting against the fanatical Japs. What many were openly feeling around the world, the fighting man here realized for the most part within himself. All knew it was an historic day, a day that would be remembered for generations to come. They also knew that it was a step toward the end of their war against Japan. Just how much of a step would remain to be seen.
For a sailor, soldier, or marine flattening himself against the ground in front of the battle-burned fortifications in which the Japs hang on tenaciously, there was little time to do much thinking. He was too busy ducking the mortar and the artillery shells.
It has been a cold, miserable day on Okinawa. The rain has been pouring down, turning everything into a quagmire of the stickiest mud imaginable. In this slop, the Japs are gradually being pushed back from their well-constructed entrenchments. It is hardly a setting for tremendous rejoicing. But the single fact that Germany has surrendered has raced across the island. As the day wore into evening, small discussions went on among the men. Corporal Ross Sinkpap of Robinson, Illinois, told me how the news had been received at the front line with the Marines. At first, they thought it was just another rumor, he said. But then they realized that it was the truth. No, there was no yelling, but most of us were pretty happy. Seaman First Class George Durant of Pittsburgh, who lost a brother on the other side, said that he thought that many of the troops over there deserved a rest. He thinks that they will be sent home, and some of the men in the States that have yet to go overseas will be sent out here. Those who will be sent directly to the Pacific will probably have to be given different training for the war against the Japs. However, he concluded, it's mighty good news. Mighty good. Then there was the sailor who exclaimed to me, I can just see my dad today. He'll have to take all those pins out of that map of his. Thus was the news received here on Okinawa. The news has changed nothing in the actual fighting. Tonight again, the Jap suicide planes may be over to keep all of us awake as they try desperately to dive into our ship. Tonight, the Japs may attempt another counterattack. All know that the final victory day is far closer, but they say to those of you at home, almost to a man, have your celebrations, but don't forget that there is still another victory day we have yet to celebrate.
This is Tim LeMert off the coast of Okinawa.
I return you now to the United States.
While our correspondents have been telling us firsthand about the reaction to VE Day around the world, we've been getting news of reaction from other points here at our Columbia News headquarters in New York. Copenhagen residents, for example, are weary after 3 days of celebrating their own liberation, but just the same crowds throng the streets in the Danish capital, parading and cheering the Allies with voices that are noticeably hoarse from thousands of hurrahs and much non-stop singing. In Rome, the reaction is both gay and sober. The Allied troops, who knew that they had fought and won, are whooping it up hilariously, but Italian citizens who know that their nation had been on the wrong side are gravely pondering the future. That's the news that we get from Rome. Australia is taking the news of VE Day very quietly. A public holiday has been proclaimed for tomorrow in Australia, and Thanksgiving services will be held in all states. Big services will be held in most public squares. The news is still coming in very rapidly now that the official day of victory has been proclaimed by President Truman and by Prime Minister Churchill at 9 o'clock in the morning New York time, in other words, just about 2 hours ago, and we have still not heard from Marshal Stalin, but as Prime Minister Churchill told us, the ceremony will be held later in the day in Berlin, at which the surrender document will be signed again and will be ratified, and it would be natural to expect that at that hour, the Moscow radio will come on with the news that this is VE Day in Russia as well. We just have news from London, as a matter of fact, that informed circles in London are paying particular attention to the passage in Mr. Churchill's victory message in which he said that tomorrow we shall pay a particular tribute to our Russian allies. And these circles in London are interpreting this statement to mean that the Russians will celebrate VE Day tomorrow after the surrender agreements have been signed, sealed, and delivered. That's the news from London. However that may be, as we told you earlier, Columbia's shortwave listening station reports that the Moscow radio has been behaving oddly. As a matter of fact, the shortwave transmitters, the Moscow transmitters, which can be heard here in the United States, went off the air at 9 o'clock, at the hour at which we were rather expecting Marshal Stalin to speak. And some 20 minutes later, they came on again without saying whether he had spoken or not, and they began to broadcast very routine communiques from Yugoslavia and from Romania, and also they began to broadcast in the Turkish language and other broadcasts that are strictly routine. So we don't really know what Moscow is going to do. It seems likely that the celebration will come after the Berlin ceremony, and whether the celebration in Russia will actually come later today or will not come until tomorrow, we just can't tell. Word from Ottawa that most Canadians today regarded VE Day as the end of the war with them, with the plans for carrying on the struggle against Japan mostly involving civilian effort. Labor Minister Mitchell announced that call-ups for military service under the National Resources Mobilization Act were suspended, but that enrollment of volunteers for the Pacific War had been made. And now we're going to have another switch to one of our correspondents abroad. We take you now to Lüneburg, Germany. Bill Downs reporting.
This is Bill Downs speaking from Lüneburg. This V-Day has started out very quietly here in Lüneburg on the British sector. The convoys continue to roar over the narrow streets and the long, long lines of surrendering Germans and liberated Allied war prisoners and slave laborers stream back to the rear areas. The people of Lüneburg are going about their business as this was just another day. It may be V-Day for the Allies, but it's surrender day for the Germans. The people I saw this morning look like they're trying to ignore the whole thing. The shops are opening up, and already the long lines at the food stores are collecting. Ex-Nazi Hausfrauen, with their baskets and string bags, beginning a life of queuing that has plagued all of Europe since the Nazis went on the warpath. It's a beautiful day here. The weatherman could not have planned more perfect weather for a surrender celebration. But right now, there's very little celebrating. The British are reserved people, and out of propriety for the French and American and Russian forces still fighting, they did no dancing in the streets when Montgomery signed the surrender terms that put the British 2nd and the Canadian 1st Armies out of the war last Thursday. But no doubt tonight, the bottles of French champagne, which we find in every rich German's wine cellar, will make their appearance. But meanwhile, the army is too busy to celebrate victory in Europe Day. The millions of German soldiers must be kept moving to the concentration areas. The liberated Allied prisoners must be evacuated, and somehow the slave laborers who look to us for help must be housed and fed. But I have an idea that tonight there will be a hot time in Lüneburg. This is Bill Downs with the British, returning you to CBS in New York.
Back again at Columbia's news headquarters in New York. This is Bob Trout speaking. This is CBS, the Columbia Broadcasting System.